they had just changed the name from architecture to environmental design. And the reason they did that was they felt that architects were the cause of a lot of the environmental problems in the world. Hmm. And they were actually anti-architecture. Hmm. And they were looking for a solution, and they were bringing in sociologists and biologists and all sorts of different people from other fields to do design work to prevent the problems that architects created. So they spent the next 3 years trying to convince me not to be an architect.
Hi. Hello.
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 Hello, and welcome to Architecting.
Hello. Welcome back to Architecting. I'm Rebecca Wagner here with the host, Adam. Hey, Adam. It's been a while.
Hey. Yes, it has been a little bit. Although we have been putting out a lot of podcasts lately, we mostly recorded them all during the AIA conference. And I'm happy to be back to the normal format. I was getting fairly tired of that other introduction I did every time.
You just missed me.
Just missed these late night.
Double recording,
messed up.
Children throwing up in the background, dog snoring.
Yeah. I think this is going to be a good one, though. I think this is going to be a good take. No pressure.
Wait, who's on the podcast today?
Today we have Harvey Hine on the podcast.
Oh.
So Harvey obviously is a big figure within Boulder architecture. He and his firm started Month of Modern, just a great event that they have going up there, or a series of events really bringing people together around architecture and discussions around architecture and just fun parties that we got to participate in last year. And, oh, thought the kids waking up again to throw up again, but it was just our refrigerator clicking on. Harvey, yeah. But yeah, getting into his firm, his background, and interesting stuff going on.
Nice. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Check it out.
And also
yes.
Someone has a new firm.
Yep. It's been 2 years, so it's time for me to start a new architecture firm. So you can go to www.highlowbuffalo.co to see the new architecture firm.
High Low Buffalo. Why would you name a firm that?
What does that mean? Go to highlowbuffalo.co for the full story. I am really excited about this. It's something that's been in the works for a long time. Just creating this new firm that can better bring together the podcast and the architecture that I'm doing, as well as another branch of it, which is a design consulting service where I'm looking forward to being able to work with other architects and help come alongside, is that the right word?
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. Yeah.
Collaborate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I really love doing is like the old studio stuff of like sitting down and talking through ideas with people. And that is a really hard thing to do if you're in a firm by yourself or two people, or just if you're looking for an outside perspective. And so that's what I am offering now. Just being able to come and what was that word? Brainstorm. Yeah. Brainstorm with people and just be a backboard.
Sounding board. Words are hard.
Look, I'm great at drawing. I'm bad with words. So go to highlowbuffalo.co and there's more information on there. This is special because it's the first episode that was recorded in this new fancy sound studio that we have, and it's all on video. And so you can go to our YouTube page and be able to watch this entire episode in brilliant color. That is now it. Enjoy.
Hey, this episode is brought to you in part by Signature Doors and Windows and Modern Denver Magazine. Now, on to the show.
Well, no, I mean, you know, thanks for coming in. Wanted to have you on for a while and invited you, and then pulled the rug out from under you and said, wait for a little bit. But
I'm here now.
You're here. And now we got you on the record. And yeah. So first question, only hard question. Party sketch statement. Who are you? Two sentences.
Two sentences. I'm a person who has some real strengths and even more weaknesses, and I've managed to do pretty well with what I've been given.
Yeah. it's like the, what is it, you know, like the 20% bad, the 20% good, and the 60%
in the middle. It's kind of how I've got 20% good, 60% bad, and 20% okay in the middle.
Yeah. Had that form up in you.
Actually, it worked really well for me because I basically was failing out of elementary school because I don't read well and I don't write well. And those are the things that they want you to do in elementary school. And I actually vividly remember being in second grade and thinking that if I'm going to succeed in life, I'm going to hire all the people in my class who do everything better than I do and rely on them. And that has been my life. I've relied on other people for doing what I am not capable of doing, and it's created a very good work environment.
Huh. That's impressive, like being able to remember that in second grade. And how did that sort of like manifest to dig you out of that hole before you could start actually hiring people? And
though I kind of dug myself out of the hole, because the further away you get from those basic things that you have to do, the better it is. So I did better in high school than I did in elementary school. I did better in college than I did in high school. And then I did well enough in college that I did fine in grad school. When you get to college, you start studying architecture, what you're into, and I didn't have to read that much because architects don't read that much. And when I got to grad school, it was architecture, and that's what I'm good at. So it was no longer such an issue.
Yeah, I love that. That's very similar to my experience, right? Of the same sort of things of like, I only want to do the things I want to do, and later on, I found out that's ADHD, but in my case, at least. But where'd you grow up? Because you weren't here, right?
No, I was born in Boston, the Boston area, and I moved to Vienna, Austria when I was 8 years old. And
Was that about second grade?
The end of second grade, beginning of third grade. Huh. That might be why I remember second grade so well, because there was a big change in my life right after that.
Yeah.
And then I was in Vienna, Austria, 8 to 18, till I graduated from high school. I recently went back for my 50th high school reunion, then came to Colorado to CU. Not because of CU and not because of architecture, but because of skiing. And I didn't know anything about the program.
Back to Austria. So, but why'd you move to Austria? What was the...
My dad had a job with the International Atomic Energy Agency. He was a nuclear physicist. And that's part of the UN, and the UN has a very big presence in Vienna.
Hmm. So what do you think, how did that, it's funny, yeah, you say, okay, yeah, you went to see you, not for architecture, but how did that experience of growing up in Austria shape you in a different way, you think, than if you would have continued to grow up in Boston?
Yeah, it's hard to know, but it certainly was a very different place. We moved there in 64, and it was still recovering from two world wars. 60% of the population were women over 60 years old, and most of them were widows. The city was still being heated by coal, so everything was a dark gray. All the buildings, everything was dark gray. So in some ways, it was a very depressing place to grow up as a kid, because I knew the United States was all about, you know, McDonald's and fun things. But on the other hand, there were so few kids there, and it was so depressing that we had free reign to do whatever we wanted. And there was no crime. So Even in fourth grade, I would take public transportation to wherever, and I never felt ill at ease. So really, it was an open opportunity for a kid because it was so non-kid-based, kind of different.
You say you could do whatever you wanted. Like, what were some of those things? Like, what?
Well, you could just randomly go places. I skateboarded. Skateboarding wasn't known in Europe at the time, so I'd take my skateboard anywhere where I could find a hill, and I'd start skateboarding. Uh-huh. And people would complain, but I didn't care.
Right. Those 60-year-old women weren't going to catch you.
I think I might be the only person who skateboarded the Montenegro Mountains. So,
so then your father's position was over when you're 18, or
actually it was over earlier. But I was so freaked out about coming back to the States that my parents decided that my mom would stay with me till I graduated, and that was probably a good move. My dad was in D.C. and it was the early 70s, and the riots were happening, and it just, for a young kid, it just felt too scary. And first thing that happened to me when I came out to look at colleges was I was mugged in the Port Authority building. So there were some transitional phases to coming back to the States.
That's funny.
That
sense of security that you were able to live with.
And I'm from the East Coast, so
right.
I thought I'd move back to the East Coast, but it was too scary for me.
Huh.
Boulder seemed really friendly and nice and hippies and easygoing, so it was a good place for me to move to. It worked out well.
And so were you into skiing in Austria then?
Yeah, I was a big skier in Austria.
And then you came to the States, started looking for schools, and
I actually didn't even look. I didn't even look for schools. I just CU was the only place I applied to. I didn't get in because I didn't have a social security number because I wasn't in the country.
Huh.
So it took a little finagling, but it worked to my favor because since I wasn't a resident of anywhere, they gave me in-state residency.
Hmm.
So that worked real well.
Hmm.
I've had a lot of luck in my life.
And then, speaking of luck, so then what pushed you into architecture? Was that a first day thing? You just threw a dart, or was it
no.
A few semesters in?
I kind of wanted to go into architecture, but I couldn't get into the program because I was such a late, without a social security number, it was too late for me to even apply to architecture. And I had multiple interests. I was interested in theater. I was interested in math. So that's what I did my first year of theater and math. After the first year of theater, my acting instructor came to me and said, "Harvey, you're really good at this. You got to make up your mind whether you're going to devote your life to the theater or not." This is, 18-year-old kid, and I'm like, "I'm out of here." I never looked back. And then in math, the next year I was taking some advanced math class, and the professor was blind, and he wrote over his previous writing on the chalkboard. And so I dropped the class, and that was the end of my math career. So I kind of went with the flow.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, maybe I should try architecture because these last two aren't working out for me.
The thing that the pendulum swing between math and theater is architecture. It's like,
kind of was in between.
Yeah.
And I was into fine arts too. So I always took classes in the fine arts building. Not an official minor in fine arts, but definitely I took a lot of credits there. Really got into jewelry making. Still make jewelry. I was making jewelry this morning.
Hmm.
So that's always been there as well.
And so when you got into the architecture program, what surprised you about that experience?
Surprised me about the experience is that they didn't like architects. This was 1975 when I got in.
Hmm.
And they had just changed the name from architecture to environmental design. And the reason they did that was they felt that architects were the cause of a lot of the environmental problems in the world.
Hmm.
And they were actually anti-architecture.
Hmm.
And they were looking for a solution, and they were bringing in sociologists and biologists and all sorts of different people from other fields to do design work. to prevent the problems that architects created. So they spent the next 3 years trying to convince me not to be an architect.
So who was the, I keep trying to figure this out of like, so yeah, who was there at the time to kind of initiate that change? Was it a new dean that came in?
Spence Havlick, he was the main guy. I think he was called the director of the program. He was a biologist, a PhD biologist, and he was the main push behind this. Yeah.
And I mean, obviously there's a pretty good lineage of modernist Boulder architects, right? Around that time.
Yeah.
And so were they
not involved in the program?
The school was, and was that part of the sort of pushback against architects that sort of scene there, or is it more national kind of?
I think it was more of a national thing. Yeah, it was more of a national thing. Yeah, Berkeley led it, and they were following Berkeley.
Yeah, like Christopher Alexander, kind of.
Christopher Alexander. I did get to meet all those really wonderful architects at the time: Charles Hartley, Rigmor Thurmer, Gail Abels. I worked for two of them, Roger Easton. A lot of really good architects at the time.
Right. And so that idea of coming in and all of a sudden being in this sort of anti-architect bubble, coming from a place like Vienna where it does have such a strong sense of architecture of itself, right?
Culture.
Yeah. And I'm assuming it's sort of like, you know, the sort of destruction of the wars and coming out of that and the kind of avant-garde that's coming out of that. Did it feel like a pinch for you of these two kind of cultures coming in? And I guess a little bit, because they didn't talk you out of being an architect. But
yeah, I wasn't so upset about the anti-architecture. I was just more upset that I was a guinea pig in a new program trying to come up with a new way of design that was failing. I understood that. And I graduated second in my class. So they were kind of like hailing me as a success story. And I went to Spence Havlick, the director of the program, when I graduated. And I said, Spence, I think I got the worst education money can buy. And he said, what would be better? I said, I don't know. I only had this one education. But he wrote a letter for me to get into grad school and got into Harvard. So, you know, we've kind of had this love-hate relationship.
But that is interesting, where you only get that one chance most of the time at your architecture education, right? Yeah. And there's so many different schools. It's so hard to sort of sample what's going on, what and how someone else does something. And I, you know, you get that a lot of sort of, okay, maybe I went to a state school or something like that. Yeah. And like my education, maybe it's not great. Like, in the Ivy League, it's better, right? And then you go to the Ivy League school, and you're like, oh, well, they don't have it all figured out either. Right. Or, you know, I don't know if this is right. But so did you take off time between the two
schools? Yeah, I worked for 2 years. Well, no, actually, that's not true. I worked for 1 year, and then we got into a terrible recession, and I lost my job, and I couldn't find work. So I got on my motorcycle and went to construction sites and got day jobs as laborers, but that was good motivation for me to work on my portfolio for grad school.
Right.
So again, I was lucky. Things just worked out. I really had lots of time, endless time for my portfolio. And what really got me into grad school was, I mean, I had a good GPA, but my jewelry. You know, they get all these different portfolios of various degrees of architecture, but there are probably not a whole lot of jewelers who submit a lot of jewelry. And the jewelry is pretty good. And I think that's got me into all the schools I applied to.
Yeah, what was the sort of concept of the jewelry at that time when you were working there?
The jewelry was, it really just came from my heart. I didn't study it from a design point of view. I didn't research it. It really just came from me. And it was totally intuitive. And it was really good. And then I went to Harvard, and Harvard was very dogmatic and very much like the Marines, where they just beat the crap out of you till you have no intuition left and
right.
no personality, and then they build you up in their image.
Right.
And that really destroyed a lot of my design capabilities. And I was there for 3.5 years, which is a long time. So I did have the opportunity to go to MIT for a while to get a third architectural education. So really kind of, and MIT and Harvard were almost opposites in terms of their philosophies.
Really?
Yeah, so.
I would have thought of it kind of a different way. So who was kind of directing the school at the GSD at that time?
I'm terrible at remembering names. It was the guy from I.M. Pei's office.
Harry Cobb?
Harry Cobb,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have no respect for that man. There was one student in my class who was extremely brilliant and creative, and he did the scheme that was deconstructivist about 2 years before deconstructivism was happening. And Harry Cobb was like, this is a train wreck. This is terrible. You know, this shouldn't be in our program. And then like 5 years later, he hires Libeskind and Morphosis and all those people. And it's like, what a bunch of crock.
Yeah. Where's that guy at now? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, this idea between, I'm always torn between the idea of the intuition and the sort of process.
I think intuition is more important.
Yeah. And I think I definitely fell more on process. And then when I went to Yale for grad school, it pushed me a little more into intuition.
And, oh, good for you.
But I'm still struggling with it because it's interesting, that idea of, it's almost like a child, you know. It's like I worked and I studied and I learned all these things, mm-hmm. and I've grown bigger, and mm-hmm. and that's how I can design better. But then there's this little kid inside of you that's uneducated and intuitive, mm-hmm. and saying, oh, maybe do that way.
Yeah.
It feels like saying no. There's the grown-ups are talking,
right.
But you're falling on the opposite of that, not the opposite, right? Because that's too simplified of a explanation of it. But
I graduated from Harvard maybe 40 years ago, and I'm just now starting to get my intuition back. It's been a long process.
So they did a good job
at
doing
good job.
What they wanted to do
the intuition. You know, you can't follow what's in the magazines if you're following your intuition. Your intuition's coming from the inside. And so it's not, you know, people might, what is this? I don't even understand it. Or as you say, it's too childish. Or
right.
That's what's really important, I think, in architecture or any design or any business. Your intuition. I've been in business for 35 years. I did take some business classes, but I think my intuition has really been the success of my business.
It's sort of this thing that stays in a way, right? I think, what did you say? Like, following your intuition is a thing that keeps you away from trends, essentially, right? Like,
you hope,
and,
yeah.
And I guess it's intuition is a sort of big word where, you know, because if you're looking at too much of somebody else's work or something like that, it can start seeping into that intuition, right?
Well, of course it can, yeah.
Yeah, but that's where I'm always trying to find that process, right? Like that starts at A, and I don't know where D is going to be, but uh-huh. but a kind of a systemized process that gets me there and surprises me and gets me away from sort of the initial things I'm thinking or what other people are doing. And I say that, but I don't know how many times it's actually worked, you know, or been able to figure out that process.
I have this thing that I sometimes do, particularly if I'm stuck in design. I will say, okay, now I'm going to draw something really stupid. I mean, stupid. I'll put palm trees in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just really make it a cartoon. And that allows the intuition to come out because you've taken away your inhibitions. Because you're saying, what I'm drawing is going to be stupid anyway, so might as well have fun with it.
Right.
And then you look at that and go, oh, well, that part of that is actually pretty clever. I didn't know that. So sometimes by purposely doing something that you think you won't like, you might come up with something pretty good.
Right. We were recently at a month of modern events together and mm-hmm. talking AI came up a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And have you started playing around with that and doing stupid things? And
no, my employees have. No, I think that AI is going to be a very good tool for creative architects. I don't know if it's going to be a good tool. Well, I think non-creative architects are going to lose their jobs because AI can do their job for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I've really been struggling. I've been wrestling with this lately, but I was playing around with Midjourney mm-hmm. yesterday. And I'd already designed the building, but I was trying to get a good background for it,
right.
You know? And so typing things in and kind of like your palm tree thing where it's like this prompt is kind of dumb and like, and then it populates this thing and you're like, oh man, that is a good looking background for this. And like, and like this building, and I don't really know what this landscape thing is, but it's like these weird benches and there's people sitting in it and it looks nice and there's trees and, and I started putting it behind my rendering, and then I zoomed in and like, the person's leg was like up here and like their other part of their leg was down there and their face was all messed up. And you know, it doesn't work, but it definitely stimulated those different thoughts and ideas.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, like, I should try it.
What was the sort of like thesis at Harvard or what was that, the final act of like being broken down and then like building up into something else? Where did you land there?
Well, my final project, we didn't really have a thesis, but my final project was a museum. I've always been, well, Austria is full of museums, nothing but museums. So, while I wasn't actively into culture growing up as a high school kid, I liked girls and motorcycles and then theater. And, you know, but I was surrounded by it. And I was forced to go to the opera and you know, museums and stuff like that. So it was in my blood. So my final project was museum, and then I was fortunate to get a job in Boston at a company called E. Werner Johnson, and they only designed museums around the world. So I worked there for a couple of years, and that was wonderful until we decided to have kids and move back to Colorado. So that was kind of the end of my museum experience, but always love to go back to that someday. It's just a wonderful building type. Then I had a really good fortune of working with Bill Mucho, who I believe historically is maybe the greatest architect in Colorado history.
Huh. Bill Mucho. Oh.
Yeah.
Was he in Boulder at the time? Or
no,
Denver?
He's Denver.
Yeah, okay.
Denver. And 100 firms came out of his office, and a lot of the really good firms that you know came out of his office. Ross Shepard might be one of them. But he was just a wonderful mentor and a wonderful person. And then we hit a recession, and I thought, well, I'm kind of bringing my own jobs into his office. I might as well bring jobs into my office. So I started my own office and started teaching to make up for the lack of money. And 35 years later, I'm still doing it.
What kind of projects was Bill doing and you doing in that?
Oh, he did the Denver Center for Performing Arts, the big archway. Mm. He did the Black Building, Central Building, you know, off of Larimer Square.
Oh, okay.
He did a lot of the skyscrapers in town. He was involved in the planning of the airport. He's just done hundreds of really great buildings.
Was it a really large firm?
Well, it was 35 people when I started and 3 when I left.
Oh. You made it down. That's why so many firms spawned off, like 32 firms spawned off from there.
Well,
right?
No, that was over like a 40-year period.
Right.
But I was, like I said, at that point, nobody was being laid off. If you could find work and bring it in, you could show up. And if you didn't have work, you didn't show up. And since I was bringing in my own work, I could stay. And then finally I said, I'm just going to take off. And that was that.
What kind of projects were you bringing into the office? How long were you there for?
I'd been there for 3 years. And there were small jobs, restaurant, maybe a pop top or something like that. And he didn't care as long as it brought in some money.
Yeah, that's a pretty different scale.
Yeah. Well, he was in a bad situation because his liability insurance premium was higher than his gross revenue.
Wow.
So
just essentially for the scale of work he was doing?
For the scale of work that he was doing, yeah. Wow. It came down so fast that the whole thing just completely fell apart.
Man, how do you get out of that hole? That's
Well, he died. Okay. That's how he did it. Oh. Yeah.
So then what was that first project that you had when you went off on your own?
There were small projects. I did steal some clients from that firm, restaurants and stuff like that. I was working out of my basement in a really crappy room. Had a fake wood paneling. Had one window that was about 3 feet wide by about a foot tall. And it was just a dismal room.
Really encourages creativity.
Really encourages creativity, but it didn't bother me. And I was teaching, and my wife is a professor, so she's making good money, steady income. Real estate didn't cost much, so we weren't much in debt. I didn't have to make much money. I didn't think I would stay in business for more than 6 months, so I didn't put a lot of anxiety into it. I just was doing what I was doing, and it just never disappeared.
Yeah. And so then going back to that sort of initial statement of needing people to help bolster you up,
that's
right?
That's a good question,
You know, that's where I'm at now. Being by myself, there's nobody to help bolster you. You know, how did you deal with that? And then how are you able to start bringing people in around you?
Well, because I was teaching, I was hiring my students to help me. And what we were doing was pretty easy. I mean, we were doing pop-tops and stuff like that, so we weren't writing grants or anything, stuff that I'm not good at. So it wasn't difficult. And my kids were small. They were probably 3 and 0 at the time. Mm-hmm. And so the first 5 years I was working at home, kids were small. It was just a really good family situation. And then after 5 years, they were school age. I became real. I moved to an office. I hired employees, real employees, full-time employees. And that was kind of the second start of the office.
So that took you like 5 years?
Yeah, 5 years. Yeah. And it was more kid-related than office-related.
Just, because they were running around and you had to...
We had nannies, but if the kid fell down the staircase and was bleeding, I could go upstairs and take care of him.
Right, yeah. Yeah. It seems funny, the amount of architects that start firms when they have an infant.
Sure. Why not?
You know, I guess why not, but it's like, you know, I guess there's never a great time to start a firm. Uh-huh. You know, there's always some pressures or something, but that moving into an office aligned with the kids' ages, but then did it also just nicely align with a uptick in projects and scale?
Yeah. I think that, you do something and there's a consequence to it. And it was a positive consequence. There were a couple of things that happened. One, we moved into an office. Two, I actually went to CAD at that point. That was like 92 or somewhere in that. And we went to ARCHICAD. So it was a BIM program. Yeah. We were one of the first BIM programs in Colorado. And we started landing big jobs. Got an office building quite quickly, a very large residence. Yeah, it's funny. You kind of open the doors and things happen.
Right. Yeah. This is the fourth time I've started a firm now. So, and so I get a lot of people asking, you know, like how do you start it or do you get nervous? And it's like each time I didn't really have a project when I opened, but for some weird reason, you get these projects flowing in when put a shingle out or like things happen so did that feel like a big step going to ARCHICAD or going to 3D at that point?
It was, because I was lucky. I've just been so lucky, but I was still young enough to learn that. And you know, I was in my 30s, and so many of my peers, they're not good at CAD
savvy.
And since I started on version 3, it was very easy to learn. Now we're on version 25, which is highly complicated. But I've had, 30 years to learn it.
Right, yeah.
So I'm good at it. But there aren't too many people my age who are as good at CAD as I am.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like it takes a certain type of person to continually push himself technology-wise, right? Mm-hmm. Like you come out of school and you're the hot shit and you know right. all the new yeah. stuff, and then it's very quickly you get passed up most of the time, right? Maybe was that like teaching part of that too, of being able to kind of stay up on technology or things, or is that just kind of your personality?
No. One of the things I can't write and I can't read and I also can't draw.
So. Boom. The whole package.
Yeah. So it's strange to have an architect who can't draw very well. So the CAD was a godsend to me.
Huh.
It was just the best thing that ever happened to me.
Huh.
And the other thing is that I'm a three-dimensional person. I'm not a two-dimensional person. That's why I do jewelry. I don't paint. I built models. I actually built models for money when I graduated and things like that. So the CAD being a three-dimensional BIM was perfect for me because it was out of the two-dimensional field. Floor plans, elevations never really meant much to me. So I just jumped right in. It was the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah. Do you feel like that influenced your work formally in a differentiating way from your peers around in Colorado that weren't using 3D software at the time, you know?
Yeah, sure. I think it gave us a head start. A lot of when you're doing really custom work, the CAD's really quite useful.
What was one of those early projects, like an early 3D project for you that you felt like you could maybe only do in 3D, you know, with this program?
Yeah, so one of our early projects, it was on a hillside in Boulder, and we have the shadow requirement that you can't shadow on the neighboring property, but it was a hillside that kind of undulated, and we want to kind of max out our site. And so with the CAD, I was actually able to draw a curved wall in plan that projected a shadow right on the plane that we're allowed to build. And you could never do that without a computer.
Right. Yeah. What was that? What's that house called on your website? It's
I don't name my projects, so my marketing person does because I don't name it.
I remember looking at it.
Yeah,
because it has a very defined, very straight wall.
Well, and then a very curved side, right? Wall.
And
yeah,
a very curved wall.
And you think that curved wall is derived from something else? It's actually the shadow
that's
casting on the property.
Yeah, yeah. No, when was that? Was early 90s? I guess
about 25 years ago or so.
Okay.
Yeah. I get my dates kind of confused back there.
Because I looked at that project and it does feel sort of like of that time, but it's very distilled down and simplified into these right. two moves, really, it seems like. And that sort of going back to that idea of the intuitive versus, it seemed like a very willful move, right? But it's not. It's informed, at least, justified.
It was convenient that I could do both. I could do something sculptural, and the curve was there for the shadow. So then it's like, okay, I got the curve. I'm going to make the glove of the straight walls and kind of hold the curve. So it was kind of a built-up composition. You've asked what was one of my most meaningful projects or what project was most meaningful to me. I think that is the one, not because of the architecture, but because of the clients. The clients were ones who really had a lifestyle that they wanted to represent in the house that they lived in. So they were not only vegan, but they only ate raw food.
Hmm.
They were minimalists. They were very successful professors at CU. He was an accomplished mountain climber, climbed Everest and all the other big mountains. And they were in their early 70s. And the house has nothing but stairs. There are stairs everywhere.
Hmm.
And we're like, should we put an elevator? And he got really mad. He said, absolutely not. I don't want to ever hear that word again.
Hmm.
I'm going to... I'm going to climb those stairs, and that's just who I am. And he's 99 years old now, and he's still climbing those stairs.
Really?
Yeah.
And no regrets?
No regrets. No, not at all. And so That was really wonderful working with them, because the architecture was so important to them. This wasn't like I saw this in a magazine, I liked it, or I really like modern, or I really like French chateaus. It was like, this is about my lifestyle.
Hmm.
And that was great.
And so how'd they find you, you know? How'd they, you find
they,
them?
They call, he was a professor, well, they're both professors. He called the dean of architecture. The dean of architecture didn't know who to recommend. He asked one of the professors, and one of the professors recommended me.
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, speaking with so many young firms, right? It's such a hard thing where you have these ideas, you have these things you believe in, but it takes a client to pay you to manifest those into a world, and it's so hard to get the client without the projects. And sometimes you just get lucky, or I guess it's more of like the work that you'd been putting in the school, and that got you those recommendations.
Right. And yeah. I mean, people say, like, why do you spend so much time on Month of Modern, or why do you go on juries, or why do you do anything? And you do it because you like to, but it comes back in spades.
Hmm.
I mean, it just comes back. If you're going to just sit in your office waiting for the phone to ring, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
But if you're out in the community doing things, and then people know you and they like you and they come to you.
But that does take patience, right? Because
it does.
A lot of times it takes a while, and
it also takes a business plan. We've been about 9 people as long as I can remember, except for during the recession where we got down to 3. But basically, we're a 9-person firm. It doesn't take that much work to keep 9 people busy, and at 9 people, I can be an architect.
Hmm.
I found that if I got bigger than that, I'm no longer an architect. I'm a manager. I'm a marketing person. I'm this or that. So by keeping the firm a certain size, I can A, be an architect, B, really communicate with my employees and collaborate and create good work. Even though architecture is my strength, without my employees, our work wouldn't be nearly as good. I mean, they really get the prize.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I like what I'm hearing here. It's like, first, I just like doing this podcast because I just get to harvest knowledge from people like you who've come before me.
Right.
But I feel so much the same way, where I'm only good at about like 20-30% of architecture, of like what you need to be a full architect. And that can be pretty frustrating sometimes, especially being a sole practitioner. But it's the idea of figuring out how to build that team and build that business model around you that helps to support that, or whatever that's the key. And then allowing each person, right, to be good at the thing they're good at and excel there, I guess. But
yeah, it took me 15 years to realize that interior designers do better interior design than architects do. You know, I'm like, I'm a Harvard guy, I can do interior design. And then after 15 years, I'm like, maybe I can't do interior design that well. And now we have 3 interior designers on staff, and you know, they've just elevated our work just exponentially.
Right. Yeah.
So
how long did it take you to get to that 9-person office from when you opened your doors, you know?
I don't remember. I'd say halfway, so maybe 15 years or something like that. And I could have there's always opportunity to grow.
Right.
But that was never never the goal. So the growth was very slow and deliberate. Even now, I wonder, like, well, that's kind of a crappy job. Should I take it just so I know that we have work, or do I wait for the really good job? So even with a smaller firm and a good reputation, you're still always wondering which jobs to take.
Right.
Yeah.
You have that system figured out?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No. Maybe it's the opposite. If you don't take the crappy jobs, the good jobs will never come.
Yeah, so. I know. But it seems like when you take the crappy jobs, then like 2 good jobs come the next week or something.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe those good jobs wouldn't have come if you didn't take the bad ones.
Right.
But no, that one can't be solved. The hardest part about architecture is having the right amount of work. because it's easy to, well, obviously have not enough work, but it's also just as scary to have too much work, mm-hmm. in which case you're working too much or you're doing lousy work.
Right.
At the right amount of work, you can really put the effort in that it takes to do something great. So we have gotten better at having the right amount of work, but it's the hardest part of our job.
Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, you are, would you say you're kind of totally focused on single family homes now, or is that the bulk of your work, or?
It is now, but I started mostly in restaurants, did medical, dental for a while, then did office buildings. We did office building downtown Boulder, right across from the post office on 15th Street. Mm-hmm. And the thing about residential has a couple advantages. One is it's a good laboratory. You can do more design experimentation than with other types of buildings. And the other is it's more recession-proof. So when I was doing office buildings, you know, interest rates go up, all your clients disappear that week. It's like, well,
right.
Put it on hold. We're gone. So there was something about the residential just fulfilling needs, but we're doing a little jewelry store now. We'd really like to do some little hotel boutiques. Mm. You know, I'd love to go back into museums. So we're not ruling those others out.
Yeah. Because that also does seem to be a sort of issue of how specialized you become, right? Mm-hmm. Versus how much of a generalist you
are. That's always a question, yeah. In the olden days, people were more accepting of generalists. You're a good architect, you're a good architect. Mm-hmm. I think people put a little bit more weight on that now than they used to. I don't know if that's really called for. I think that if, let's say, I were to get a library right now, I wouldn't hire, I'd be on a team, and there would be a library specialist on the team.
Right.
So the parts that I'm providing for, the public spaces, things like that, I'm already good at, and then other things like the library aspects of it, the books, the audio, video and stuff like that, they would be, you know, would be working together. So I think you can be still a generalist if you put the right teams together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are buildings that I know I don't like to do. I don't like to do institutional buildings because you're working with basically committees of people who don't want to be there.
Right.
And I did a post office distribution plant once, and it was just horrible. Everybody was hiding information from me, and nobody was, there was no team spirit at all. It was like turfdom. So I'm like, I'm not doing any more institutional work. So, but anything for a client, and even when we were doing office buildings, we weren't doing it for developers, we were doing it for the users. A law office would say, I want to do an office building, we would do an office building for the law office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when I think of you and your work, you know, I do think of these high-end residential homes, these nice mm-hmm. homes. What's a project you've completed recently that you feel like maybe really gets to that root of sort of the architecture you want to be doing, or that brings forth that, like, manifests that intuitive spirit best? Or
because I'm a jeweler and that's very small and creative, the house is the next step up from that. So going from jewelry to skyscraper makes less sense from going to jewelry to houses. I can be more experimental with form and things like that in houses. I think the main place where I'm at right now is I've got really good architects working for me, and obviously they want to do the architecture that's meaningful to them. But I still have agendas of things that I want to accomplish. So how do I work with them and not be a real jerk about, you know, I'm the boss, I don't have many years left, do what I want to do.
You've got more time than me.
You've got more time than me.
Yeah, right.
So I really do appreciate what they want to do, but I also want to do some of the experimental, intuitive things that I want to do. So that is both exciting and kind of frustrating at the same time.
Right. When it's interesting, I didn't realize you were a jewelry designer, but thinking about like the Sloan Lake house, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And that stair inside.
Right.
it seems yeah, like this carved piece of, yeah. I don't know, but what was the idea around that house and how that kind of became?
Let's talk about the stair, because the rest of the house is pretty basic Bauhaus modern, but the stair is this kind of sculptural element in the middle of the house that ties the house together horizontally and vertically. And I don't remember whose idea was what. I don't think that's important. But Neil Evers was the project architect on that, and I'm sure we communicated about doing a stair that was different than anything we've seen before, and I'm sure I brought up the jewelry. And Neil has more CAD capability, because that was really a Rhino project. That was not an ArchiCAD project, and he knew Rhino. So he was able to design this very sculptural stair. So even though it looks like a piece of jewelry, and it may have been my idea or maybe not, or the owner's or Neil's, Neil was the one who created it with obviously everybody's input.
Right.
And the owner didn't have an art collection, but he really wanted to build the house first, and the house would be the museum for a future art collection. And the stair was really the first piece of art to go into the house. And since then, he has been buying world-class art. I mean, it's really quite amazing. He's followed through on that. So it really is a residential museum.
It gets you to your museum,
yeah.
Scratches your museum itch.
Yeah, and it also shows that working with others, you can come up with something better than you could come up on your own. I couldn't have designed that stair. I guess I could have built a hand model of it and then had somebody scan it or something like that.
Right.
But, Neil was very influential on that.
Well, it does seem like, you know, I have some friends in your office, and it seems like people, you have this group of nine people or whatever, and they stay for a pretty long time.
They do.
And,
yeah.
And you don't have a lot of turnover. And
yeah.
How do you accomplish that, especially in these times?
Because we're a design office and we are into work-live. People in the office really don't work more than 40 hours a week. And we're a design office and we do Month of Modern. We don't make a lot of money. And
that just keeps people there.
It's something I worry a lot about.
Right.
And how we can be more efficient and do what we do without having them work 70 hours a week and have them paid better. We have gotten better at it. I think they're being paid on equal scale to other companies, but they're certainly not being paid higher than other companies, and yet they're staying. And when I talk to them, they go, well, this is the type of company I want to work for. I want to work for a company that does Month of Modern. I want to right. work for a company that wins the AIA Firm of the Year award.
Right.
We've won over 50 awards.
Wow.
We get a lot of recognition.
Yeah. Let's talk about, yeah, Month of Modern. How'd that come about, and give a sort of like overview of what it's become and turned into?
Well, it kind of started just as it is now. It started for our 25th year anniversary of the firm. And we're thinking, well, should we have a party? What should we do for the 25th anniversary? And it was like, let's give back to the community. Let's do something that the community will enjoy and can educate them about design. And we hired a event planner and kind of brainstormed with her types of things that we could do. And I think we started with four or five events, which kind of we still do now. There wasn't a house tour then, but there were some pretty good events, and it was a big success. And so we did it the second year, and then we did the third year. And after a while, people in the community were like, hey, I'm really looking forward to Month of Modern next year. And then we felt, well, now we have an obligation to keep it going.
Right.
And this year is a big year, because it's now we separated out of the firm, and it's a 501(c) nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
So that's a big step.
And that's, 10 years?
10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was always this thing that I heard about, and having young kids, it was always hard to get up to Boulder and things. Yeah. And I really enjoyed being invited up there to do that little event with you, and then going for the final party, and that was a good just a fun event, you know, and just getting people together and celebrating the community, and just it's so easy not to get together with people in this profession or just keep your head down and do your work and go home, but to like really be able to celebrate those things is rare. And
it's also a reaction to the AIA losing interest in at the local level.
Right. Yeah.
AIA has really gone to national issues like global warming and things like that, rightfully so, but mm-hmm. they've just totally eliminated the local level of getting the community involved. And I was president of the North chapter of the AIA, and I was trying to get it through the AIA, and it was very frustrating. I thought, with the number of hours I'm putting in for the AIA, I could do a lot more on my own.
Right.
And I was right.
Yeah. And it's nice to be, I was talking to Stephanie about this, right? It's nice to be, no strings attached to another organization and be able to flip and do whatever you want and change. And that's how this podcast was as well. I was kind of like, okay, I don't know how to do it. Maybe the AIA can help me, and kind of reaching out to them and seeing, and like no interest. And I was like, okay, I'll just do it myself. And
or if they have interest, they'll start telling you what to do.
Right.
You got to do this. You got to do that. You can't do this. Even now we invite them, we say, you can be a sponsor on this event. And they go, well, if we're going to be sponsors, then you have to do this, that, and that, and that. And I'm like, we're offering you something for free and you're telling us what to do. So go away.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was fairly frustrated with them and sort of the lack of engagement, but I'll have to say, although it's sort of changed, I'd say recently, and you know, they invited me to the conference and set up a whole booth for me and really helped me engage in that way. But
I think Mike is appreciating what you're doing and what we're doing. I mean,
right. Yeah.
He gave Stephanie the president's award.
Yeah, well, exactly.
He didn't, but the board did. And so that's a wonderful recognition.
Yeah. It just takes 10 years. You just need to live for 10 years.
Well, if you live long enough, you can get a lot of stuff.
You can get a lot of awards. Yeah. Not always, but yeah. I mean, thinking about sort of next steps and what does get you excited about things coming up, and
I'm never short of things that I want to do. I currently want to get back to my European heritage. Mm. I'm actually a German citizen as well.
Mm.
And I want to go back to Vienna, and I've already started the process, but connecting with the architects there. And maybe doing some joint projects, or at least crits with people there, or cultural exchange there. When I go visit a country or a city, I usually look for the best architect there, and then I email them and say, you want to get together for lunch and stuff like that?
That's a good idea.
And it's created some really good friendships and some projects. There's a architect in Merida, Mexico, and we've worked on projects together, and we crit each other's work. And
Who's that?
It's FGL Architecture, Fernando, and he publishes more than I do. And I call him a kid, but he is. He's in his 20s, maybe he's 30 by now, but just super talented guy. So I think that's the next step. My office can really run itself. Of course, I like to be involved in design and everything, but I'd like to start expanding out.
Yeah. And I love that idea. And I like that of, you know, a lot of times it's easy to not be intimidated, but that idea wouldn't necessarily come up to go see the best, knock on the door of the best architect in Guadalajara or something, right?
Yeah.
But it's not hard.
Why not?
I would love someone to come do that to me. Yeah. And it builds these things. The worst thing they can say is no, or not respond. And I think in general, like just doing this podcast, that's one of the biggest things I've figured out, right? It's like, you can just reach out to people and you can just ask questions and you can learn. And, you know, there's so many students that I kind of talk to, and they'll say, you know, okay, hey, can you help connect me with this person so I can give him a resume for a job? And it's like, don't ask for a job. Like ask for a coffee, become friends with them and be interested and not just, hey, you have a job or not.
Yeah.
But I like that idea of taking it more globally and making these connections and getting you a museum here in the next few years or something. But
just getting to know different cultures and different people at my age is really exciting.
Yeah. Well, you know, thanks for coming on here. Sure. Thank you for
connecting.
Thanks for all the work you've been doing in the community, and especially with Month of Modern and with that whole team, that great team you've got. So it's been fun talking.
Well, you're a real asset to our profession. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
You can visit architecting.com, that's architect-ing.com, to see images from this week's guest.
And please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.
Have a great week and keep connecting.
Hi, I'm Eli. This show is made by my mom and dad and these people.
Heidi Mendoza. Emily Child.
Fernando Queiroz.
Zach Huff.
Trevor Notzko.
Aaron Best.
Kyle Brunner.
Rob Cleary.
This podcast is powered by The Plug.
This is Sarah Hubbard, host of You and Me Kid, a podcast about starting and raising a family on your own. We just launched season 2, and I'm speaking with single moms, those still considering, and experts in relevant fields to give you a real sense of what the day-to-day experience of solo parenting looks and feels like. Plus, this season, I've partnered with California Cryobank, the number one sperm bank in the U.S. So wherever you are in the process, this podcast provides some support, humor, and helpful information. Listen to You and Me Kid wherever you get your podcasts.